Kelly. I have prepared remarks. I have a 2.5-year-old, so I feel that if I don't have prepared remarks, then I'll start singing in the middle of my remarks, right? There is no question that Harold Bodder's book, Migration, Borders, and Freedom, is timely and important. He begins his book in the introduction by citing events that highlight the abysmal reality of migrant deaths. I will begin my remarks by affirming that since the book's publication in 2017, more atrocious stories documenting the abuses that migrants undergo have been in the news. These are stories that I culled from my Google Alert news feed over the last 3 days. In the United States, we've all heard of Trump's policies of separating migrant children from their parents at the border. Even though Trump responded to the backlash by reversing his policies, lasting trauma remains. According to the New York Times, many migrant children remain in the United States while their parents are deported. This week, the U.S. government quietly moved migrant children from shelters to a tent city in Texas. The U.S. government now detains 13,000 migrant children. In Italy, far-right Interior Minister Matteo Salvini's decision to prevent NGO ships carrying rescued North African migrants have led to an average of 8 deaths per day, according to the International Organization for Migration. Current estimates show that 1 in 5 migrants who were attempting to get to Italy die, the highest it has been since 2012. In Myanmar, the ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims, which has led 700,000 Rohingya to flee the country, has led to an enormous refugee crisis. Most have fled to neighboring Bangladesh, with some heading to India, Pakistan, and Nepal. These states, however, are hardening their borders. India has detained 200 Rohingya asylum seekers on charges of illegal entry and is scheduled to deport 7 Rohingya men back to Myanmar today on security charges. All over the world, from Canada, where successive provincial conservative governments have been elected in part because of anti-immigrant sentiment, the most recent one being the CAQ in Quebec 2 days ago, to the United States, to Great Britain, to Italy, to Hungary, to many other countries, far-right parties endorsing nativist platforms are being elected. Reading Migration, Borders, and Freedom in light of these events makes all too clear the contemporary significance of the book. The book itself is divided into 2 parts. Part 1 looks at current conditions, diving into historical perspectives on the border, different perspectives on how the border is enforced. For example, bordering practices takes place beyond physical borders, and the various normative positions that people hold with respect to calls for open borders and no borders. I very much appreciated the section and like Harold's Hegelian dialectical approach, where he argues that, quote, the ability to notice multiple aspects of the border and migration is an important first step towards critical engagement, end quote. This allows us to see the contradictions that characterize border practices that enable, for instance, the mobility of capital and the immobility of labor. Understanding that borders themselves are ambiguous and have meanings that are tied to, quote, particular uses, practices, and experiences, end quote, is a useful practice, encouraging us to be more exacting when discussing what we mean when we talk about the border. I see some of my students here, so in your papers, when you talk about the border, make sure you define how you understand the border. Harold's dialectical approach also unearths the contradictions between the politics behind calls for no borders and the vision of open borders, which for me was constructive to read, for it allows me to see that these need not be opposing calls. In fact, ever since I've read the book, I've been mulling over Harold's references to Ernst Bloch's writings on utopia and the different layers of possibility. Harold describes Bloch as describing the multidimensional realms of possibility by using the analogy of a flower. To quote, a blooming flower has the inner capacity to ripen into a fruit, but only under the outer conditions of suitable weather and climate. Similarly, Harold argues that, quote, and I'm just going to read this because I think this is a very important passage, society has the inner capacity to provide freedom of migration, equality, and social justice under the outer condition of the territorial nation state. Similar to weather and climate, the territorial nation state is a condition that currently exists and that is therefore imaginable. However, unlike in biology, where the ripening of a flower into a fruit is necessary and a predictable outcome once all the required conditions are met, in the human world, achieving the possible is a political activity, It requires creativity to mediate between inner capacity and outer material conditions. In other words, achieving the contingency possible is a dialectical process that involves human engagement. Harold thus emphasizes the necessity of pursuing both the contingently possible and possibilia. Harold explores further possible solutions in part two of the book. Part two of the book was compelling for me, but also a source of some frustration. In fact, all of my comments relate to part two of the book, which I will get to in a second. Part two starts by looking at the various ways citizenship and membership rights are accorded, from citizenship by blood to citizenship by birth, to Harold's preferred arrangement, domicile-based citizenship or citizenship based on effective residence. It then discusses the emergence of sanctuary cities and the right to the future, addressing how utopian visions rests on a reimagining and a re-envisioning of scale. Much of Harold's discussion of new possibilities, in fact, seems to me to rest on an elevation of the urban as a, quote, catalyst for acting in solidarity and forming new identities, end quote. As I was reading this and trying to see what exactly possibilia looks like for Harold, the book ends. I was so excited to read more about possibilia that I was a bit surprised that immediately following chapter 7 is the conclusion, which reiterates Harold's belief that concepts such as territories and scales of belonging matter on the road towards possibilia, and his contention that migration and freedom also need to be rethought. I was hoping there would be another 3 chapters unpacking possibilia. I would therefore like to encourage Harold to perhaps speak a little bit more about his visions of possibilia. Here are 2 specific questions I have in this regard. First, Harold highlights the urban as containing multiple possibilities for descent and transformation. He cites the emergence of movements such as sanctuary cities and No One Is Illegal as first emerging in cities and discusses the potentialities of other urban practices. I wonder why the city? Much as the city is the genesis for a lot of subversive practices, I also wonder about the transformations that take place in, for example, different scales. California, for example, has established itself as a sanctuary state, and different university campuses across the United States, in opposition to Trump, have deemed themselves sanctuary campuses. I also wonder whether we are idealizing the city. My partner manages the poverty reduction division in the city of Toronto, and frequently I hear about the difficulties of trying to pursue equity goals in the municipal realm. There are problems that plague cities that arguably don't plague other configurations: affordable housing, affordable transit, an absence of daycare space, etc. Cities, in particular, hyper-capitalist megacities such as Toronto, Hong Kong, Vancouver, New York, Singapore, Manila, all places where I've done fieldwork, are also sites where migrant workers face a multitude of inequalities. When I was in Hong Kong, I was struck with how the spatialities of the city constrict migrant workers. There are norms about where migrant domestic workers can and cannot go on Sundays during their days off, with most inhabiting public spaces like downtown central, public parks, etc. The absence of physical space also meant that employers tried to meet the Hong Kong government's policy that all migrant domestic workers have to be given their own private dwellings in their households by having them sleep in kitchens, in bathrooms, on top of a cabinet, in a horrific example during my fieldwork, in a box that resembles a coffin in the balcony of an apartment. So I do wonder about the elevation of the urban as a site of resistance. Harold does recognize this, citing the limitations of the urban and people's different experiences of the city. He paraphrases in the book, "The city air cannot be breathed freely by different inhabitants." So I wonder, are we foreclosing other possibilities by zeroing in first on the urban? What other possibilities exist out there? Second, I really want Harold to discuss his vision of social justice and of possibilia. Faye Faraday, a friend and a colleague, teaches a course that asks her students to free write what they think social justice looks like. I adopted this exercise too, do you remember that? And I found that students are stuck. They cannot think beyond the nation state, beyond notions of sovereignty, beyond the belief that the categories that have been imposed on us as citizens, as visitors, as PR status holders, etc. These limit the scope of our imagining. And so I invite Harold to perhaps share with us what he envisions as a just world. He is right in noting that, quote, humanity will create a world that we cannot fathom from our current viewpoint, end quote. What for Harold does such a world look like? Again, I feel like there should be three more chapters because I got to that conclusion and I was like, okay, what do you think? What does possibility look like? Please note that I started my academic career as a political theorist, so I actually like reading about possible new worlds. My observations notwithstanding, this is an excellent book. I commend Harold for the superb work. It is thought-provoking and concise, engaging and smart. It should be required reading not just for those of us who undertake immigration and citizenship research, but also for anyone who cares about what's happening in the world today.
Nice. Okay.
Back to me?
Sure.
Okay, well, thank you for the kind words. Yeah, that's great. Thanks. But I also realize you're pointing to a bit of a dilemma with this possibilia idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really following Adorno here, mm-hmm. in a way that the possibilia, what I understand is possibilia is something that cannot possibly define from our current vantage point, because by the very definition we don't have the concepts and the ideas and the structures in place to even describe it. And Adorno would say, as soon as we try, we're fixing it.
Yeah.
Because we still have to use the language and the concepts, and then already we're doomed, right? Because mm-hmm. we're defining it. And that's a problem with utopia, I mm-hmm. think. That when you, I don't know whether anyone has read the original Utopia text. It was published in 16-something. The story is that the author Moore, he met a hypothetical character who was a seafarer and visited different parts of the world and encounters this island called Utopia on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean, I think somewhere it was. And then the author narrates what the traveler has told him what the conditions were, and it was very concrete. Circumstances that were described in this book. So it was a kingdom. I forgot the details, but it had social justice. It had all kinds of technology. It had a particular social structure. It also had slavery, religious freedom, and so forth. So it was defined in very concrete ways. And I think this possibilia is not a utopia in that sense, because it's not concrete. It's not something that's definable. That's the whole point of having the concept. and that puts us in a dilemma that, yes, the book ends here because I can go anywhere else with it. That doesn't mean that it's a real possibility, because it does exist. Yeah? Not only in the future, but also the present. But it's just something that cannot be described. And that's the dilemma and the problem, I think. But that doesn't mean that we will arrive there. And that's the same idea with social justice. The whole notion of social justice to me is something that is very contingent on particular current and geographically referenced circumstances. So you can think about social justice in these and these kind of circumstances. But if these circumstances don't exist, and then the whole notion of social justice has a different meaning. So it's also very difficult in terms of thinking in terms of social justice if you don't know what the kind of circumstances are and what kind of language and what kind of concepts you're using. Again, that's the same similar kind of dilemma. And even if the term social justice is even a term that is relevant in this realm of possibility. So I'm kind of repeating myself, and I'm applying the same thing to the city. the city, I'd have to say I'm biased towards the city throughout my own research program. I've been an urban geographer for a few decades, and this is what I've been doing, and this was a case that I could present as an illustrative example. But I didn't want to exclude other parts. I think actually moving ahead and approaching possibilia, it would probably be very important to step out of this urban context and maybe even leave the entire urban category behind. because it's again the kind of category that we have available as a concept, as a resource to us right now in the present, that we can think of a city. But maybe that's not all that, maybe we can't think of it in kind of political arrangements, humanity in other ways.